Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Game of Gods by Scarlett St. Clair, narrated by Tyler Dunn. Everything is more beautiful because we're doomed. Homer, The Odyssey. We lovers fear everything. Ovid, Metamorphoses. My vengeance is my guilt. Ovid, Metamorphoses. Chapter 1. Hades. Hades stood a few feet from a burning farmhouse. All that remained was the frame, a faint outline of what the house once was. And yet the flames still raged, filling the night with smoke and ash. At his feet was the corpse of an old man, the farmer who had lived within, his back full of bullet holes. Nearby, his soul drifted, unaware that it had departed his physical body, executing what Hades could only assume was his nighttime routine. That was usual for any mortal who experienced sudden death. The old man had not seen this coming. Not that he should have. The only thing this farmer was guilty of was seeing the Ophiotaurus, a half-bull, half-serpent monster, that was also a prophesied god-killer. Someone had caught wind and visited the farmer to learn more under the guise of authority, and once they had what they wanted, they killed him. Hades felt Thanatos's magic flare as he manifested beside him, a slice of shadow that blended in with the night. Even his pale hair and face caught the reflection of the flame. Neither of them spoke. There was no need. Nothing could be done beyond guiding the farmer's soul to the underworld. Once he was settled in Asphodel, it was possible he might be able to give them information on who had murdered him. But Hades worried it would be too late. By then, there would be more sightings of the Ophiotaurus, and whoever was after it would continue to leave a trail of bodies behind until they caught up with the monster.
I mourn deaths like these the most, said the god of death.
Murders? Hades asked.
He did not have long left on this earth, and yet his life was taken away.
Hades said nothing, but he agreed. This farmer's death was not necessary. The only useful information he might offer was confirmation that the Ophiotaurus lived. But there were other ways to validate that rumor, and they did not involve killing. Hades would find whoever had done this, and their punishment would be swift and fitting. His eyes shifted from the fire to the farmer's soul, which was now frantically trying to enter the burning barn, likely attempting to reach the animals within, but they were already gone. Give him peace, Hades said. At this point in his long life, he did not often feel sympathy for the dead. But in these moments, when the cruelty of humanity was most evident, the burden of granting relief weighed heavily. Thanatos nodded, stretching his wings as he made his way toward the soul. Hades left the scene, wandering into the vast field beyond the farmer's home, far from the glow of the fire. Overhead, the stars glimmered so bright they cast shadows, his the greatest among snow-dusted blades of grass. It was freezing, though it was summer, an untimely gift from Demeter, the goddess of harvest. There were no coincidences. On the night he had officially proposed to Persephone and she accepted, the storm had begun. It was Demeter's declaration of war, and the weapon she would use to tear them apart. It seemed insignificant, just a few frozen drops, but it was just the start of something worse to come. People would die. It was a matter of time. And when that happened, would Persephone fight for their love, or would she give in to her mother to save the world? He hated that he believed the latter. He realized it was a horrible position, an impossible one. If Demeter truly loved her daughter, she would never have given her the ultimatum. Hades considered these things as he searched the sky, eyes connecting stars. Among the sketches they made, he noted Cetus, the sea monster, slain by Heracles, Auriga, the Greek hero raised by Athena, Ares, the golden ram whose fleece could cure any living thing, and Orion, the hunter who dared to cross Gaia. But Taurus, the constellation set at their center on the Ophiuchus's death during the Titanomachy, was gone. It was the evidence Hades had been looking for. What Ilias had said was true. The monster had been resurrected. Not that he hadn't believed him, but rumors did not make something true. "Fucking fates," he growled, and he was right to curse them. Lachesis, Clotho, and Atropos had orchestrated this resurrection, though he knew it had only come about because he had killed Briareus, one of the Hecatoncheires, the hundred-handed giants who had aided the Olympians during the Titanomachy. Hera, the goddess of marriage, had seen an opportunity for revenge against the giant who had helped Zeus escape his bindings when she, Apollo, and Athena attempted to overthrow him. "A soul for a soul," the fates had said. He felt a pang in his chest, remembering how Briareus had died. There had been no grief, no begging or anger, only peaceful acceptance. Perhaps that was the worst part, the trust the giant had placed in him, that it had been his time to go, and not that his death had been ordered by another god. And even as Hades had taken Briareus's hand and drew his soul from his body, like a slice of shadow shaken from the darkness, he had known the consequences would be far-reaching, beyond even what the fates could weave. Because once Zeus and Briareus's brothers, Gyges and Cottus, discovered what he had done, he would no longer have their support or allegiance. Not that he believed either brother would choose him over Zeus. He was not the one who had rescued them from the darkness of Tartarus. Still, they had been allies to the Olympians in the war against the Titans, helping drive the elder gods into the depths of Tartarus. It meant that if Hades found himself in opposition to Zeus, as he was certain to, especially given his engagement to Persephone, he would not have the help of the two remaining giants when things came to a head, and he could not blame them. Hades had repaid their loyalty with an execution. The god of the dead left the field, manifesting in his office at Nevernight. As soon as he appeared, silence descended, thick and heavy. He looked at those gathered, Ilias, Zophi, Dionysus, and Hermes. Hades' eyes dropped to the god of mischief, who was reclined in his chair, feet propped on his desk. Their eyes met, and a sheepish smile broke out across his golden face. Hades scowled, showing his teeth, and sent the god scrambling to his feet. "I was just keeping it warm," Hermes defended. Hades glared and took his seat. It was indeed warm, which only made him stare harder at the god. "Nothing but the best for the king of the dead," Hermes added with a cheerful grin as he moved to sit on the edge of Hades' obsidian desk. "If so much as one of your ass cheeks touches this desk, Hermes, I will turn it to lava." "It's not as if they're bare," Hermes argued. Hades gave the god a withering look. "You know what? The couch is far more comfortable anyway," Hermes said, perching on the armrest. Hades turned his attention to those gathered, in particular Dionysus. He hung back, not quite part of the group, likely because he did not wish to be. He was dressed far more casually than usual, in dark trousers and a beige sweater. His thick braids were tied back, and his arms were crossed over his chest. He looked frustrated, and if Hades had to guess, it had little to do with his summons to Nevernight, and everything to do with the mortal detective Dionysus was harboring at his club, Ariadne Alexiou. Hades was surprised he had come, though it likely only had to do with his curiosity. Dionysus had a strained relationship with the Olympians, mostly due to Hera's hatred of him, which was why he had finally decided to take a side. But Hades was not stupid. He knew that did not mean Dionysus was loyal to him. It only meant that the god of madness was loyal to himself. "The Ophiuchus has been resurrected," Hades said. "Its constellation is no longer in the sky." There was a certain amount of dread that came with saying the words aloud that Hades had not expected to feel. But he was responsible for this, which meant he was also responsible for the fallout if the creature fell into the wrong hands. "Ilias," Hades said, meeting the satyr's gaze. He stood beside Zophi, hair as curly as the horns jutting from his head. "Tell us what you have learned about the monster."
"So far, there has only been one sighting. A farmer outside Thebes claimed he heard a strange bellow in the middle of the night. He thought one of his cows had been injured, but when he went to investigate, he found a half-bull, half-serpent creature coiled around it. Once it had spotted him, it slithered away into the grass."
Ilias paused and glanced at everyone gathered.
"The cow did not make it."
There was a beat of silence as Hades added, "Neither did the farmer." Ilias's jaw tightened.
"He was perfectly well yesterday."
"And today he is dead," Hades said, "full of bullets."
"So someone other than us wants the creature," said Dionysus. "Not surprising, but who?
Isn't that the question of the hour?"
Hades stared hard at the god of the vine. Not that he suspected Dionysus had anything to do with the farmer's death. He was, however, aware that he enjoyed collecting monsters as much as Poseidon. It was one reason he preferred keeping the god close, even with their new and fragile alliance. Dionysus narrowed his eyes.
"How did the creature come to be resurrected, Hades?"
The god of the dead did not like the accusation in his voice. But Hades was not Dionysus, and he would not hide from his responsibility.
"Because I killed an immortal."
Dionysus's harsh features softened, but not out of sympathy. It was shock.
"This is the work of the fates," Hades said.
"So you summoned us to handle the aftermath of your actions," Dionysus said, his voice dripping with disdain.
"Typical."
"Do not act so superior, Dionysus," Hades said. "I know how you like monsters." He could have attempted to explain himself. He knew the god hated Hera, and one mention of how she'd had a hand in all this would quell Dionysus's judgment. But in truth, he did not feel like it mattered. Either way, Dionysus wanted to be here, and he would want the Ophiuchus in his possession, which meant he would search for it, even if he chose not to help Hades directly.
"If this is the work of the fates," said Zophi, "can you not just ask them what they have woven?"
"The fates are gods, just as I am," said Hades. "They are no more likely to tell me their plans than I am to admit mine."
"But they are the fates. Are they not already aware?"
Hades did not respond. There were times when he appreciated Zophi's naivete. Tonight, it was frustrating. It was difficult to pin down how the fates operated. Much of their decision-making was based on their mood, as with most gods.
It was possible they had only orchestrated the resurrection of the Ophiuchus to fuck with him. But it was also possible they wanted to see an end to the Olympians. Hades could not say which, or even if they had chosen. He only knew one thing to be true. Fate could not be avoided, just prolonged.
"Whatever their plan, we must have one too," he said.
"I do not understand," said Zophie. "The fates have already chosen an end. For what do we plan?"
"We plan to win," said Hades.
It was all they could do, and hope that if the fates had not given him or the Olympians their favor, they could be swayed. But that would never happen without action. He knew better than anyone that the three sisters took joy in watching the gods play into their hands, especially under the weight of suffering. There was a beat of silence, and then Dionysus spoke.
"What is the prophecy that makes this creature so dangerous?"
He would not know, given he had been born after the Titanomachy.
"Whoever burns its entrails will obtain the power to defeat the gods," said Hermes.
"Are you certain that's the prophecy?"
asked Dionysus, raising a dark brow.
"Maybe it's just one god?"
Hermes wondered aloud, and then shrugged. "I might have gotten a word or two wrong."
"A word or two?"
"It isn't as if it hasn't been 4,000 years, Hermes said defensively. "You try remembering something after that long."
"You seem to have no issue recalling grudges from that long ago."
"I suddenly regret helping Zeus save your life," said Hermes.
Sometimes Hades forgot the two had a history, though it was minor. Hermes had helped save Dionysus after he was born by taking him to be raised by the Nisaeans, ocean nymphs who lived on Mount Nysa.
"Perhaps it would have been better for everyone if you had not," said Dionysus.
The god of mischief blanched at his words, and before a strained silence could descend, Hades spoke.
"It's a prophecy, Hermes. A word or two can change the entire meaning."
Hermes threw his arms in the air.
"Well, I never claimed to be an oracle."
"Then we will have to ask one," Hades said.
Perhaps the prophecy had changed. Maybe there was no prophecy at all. Just as that thought rolled through his mind, he knew it was too much to hope for. The fates would not bring the creature back if they didn't want it to challenge the gods.
"And we must find the Ophiuchus before anyone else."
"Who are we racing?" asked Dionysus.
"My money's on Poseidon and his offspring," said Hermes. "That fucker is always looking for power."
Hermes hit on something Hades had also been thinking. The Ophiuchus could live on land, but it also thrived in water. Poseidon would jump at any chance to overthrow Zeus, but so would Theseus and Hera. Hades already knew the demigod and the goddess of marriage were working together, though he also suspected the god of the sea fed Theseus's desire to overthrow the Olympians. Whether he actually believed his son was capable was another matter. Sometimes, Hades wondered who was orchestrating the game and who was just playing it. But he knew one thing. If he could become the mastermind, he would.
"We cannot let it take refuge in the sea," Hades said. It would be in his brother's territory and virtually unreachable. Even if Hades were to offer a bargain, Poseidon would not give up such a weapon.
"Then we are wasting precious time talking when we should be hunting," said Dionysus.
"The issue, Dionysus, is where to begin," said Hades, looking at the god. "Unless you have information the rest of us do not."
Dionysus did not speak.
"We must be careful in our inquiries," said Ilias. "Word has already spread among the market. Everyone within those channels will expect your involvement."
And they were right to.
though Hades knew that would not be a deterrent. In the seedy world of the black market, few feared his wrath, though he hardly saw that as an insult. It was hard to fear death when faced with it every day. Still, it meant that he would be locked in a competition to locate perhaps one of the greatest weapons ever created against the gods.
"Then perhaps my maenads should make the inquiries," Dionysus suggested.
But Hades ignored him and looked at Ilias.
"Put Ptolemaeus on the case, but watch him. I trust no one in this matter."
"Even me, apparently," Dionysus said.
Hades returned his gaze to the god of wine.
"Let's not pretend you haven't already sent your assassins to scout. You don't wait for permission, you take it."
Dionysus pursed his lips and looked away. Hades could not tell if he was amused or annoyed.
"And what is to be done with it when it is found?" asked Zophie. "Will you kill it?"
Hades did not respond, because he did not know the answer to her question. He supposed it depended on what the oracle had said about the creature's powers, though he doubted anyone else searching for the Ophiuchus would think twice about whether the prophecy still rang true. That creature had a bounty on its head and a ticking clock on its heart.
"You're all dismissed," Hades said. He was ready to be back in the underworld with Persephone. It was where he should have been this entire night, curled around her warm body in the aftermath of their lovemaking. It made him irate that he had not been able to remain at her side. Even on the night of their engagement, he had been away while she slept, gathering intel on the Ophiuchus and attempting to discover where Demeter had taken refuge. He tried not to think of this as an omen for what was to come, but he knew a battle lay ahead. He had always known it would not be easy to make Persephone his wife, given that her mother was one of his most vocal critics. And while the snow swirling outside in the middle of summer concerned him, he was more worried about Zeus. His brother liked control, especially where other gods were concerned, and that included a say in who they married. Hades clenched his fist at the thought. He would marry Persephone no matter the consequences, because in the end, a life without her was not a life at all.
Chapter 2. Dionysus. Dionysus left Nevernight and returned to Bacchaia, to the suite where he usually stayed despite having an estate of his own on the outskirts of Thebes. It was not that he found one place more comfortable than the other. He found no place particularly comfortable. It was that he could not handle the quiet of his home. Peace did not calm him. It only gave rise to louder, more incessant thoughts. Even now, he was not completely free of them, of the endless voice in his mind that told him he had not done enough, that he was not enough. But at least here he could drown it out with the noise, the revelry, the madness. He looked on it all now from the quiet of his suite, which had been abandoned by the usual carousers while he had answered the summons to Nevernight. Despite the early morning hour, his club teemed. Music vibrated his very soul and made his heart stutter in his chest. Laser lights cut through the darkness, highlighting sweaty and flushed faces, illuminating acquaintances and lovers locked in carnal embraces. The musty scent of sweat mixed with the noxious odor of drugs seeped through the vents and burned his nose. He was used to it, the sounds, the smells, the sex. It was part of the culture that had formed around his cult, one he had led with his maenads from town to town, leaving a trail of blood in his wake. And while he had long abandoned that life, he would never quite be free of the madness Hera had stricken him with. Now and then he could still feel it. It was a subtle tremor that consumed his body, and as it spread, it was warm
and made him feel pierced through with pins and needles. It made it impossible to sit still, impossible to rest. Just the thought made his fingers shake. He curled them into fists and held his breath, hoping to quell the feeling before it moved up his spine and into his veins, before it consumed him again. But as he focused, he became aware of a sound coming from somewhere inside his suite. It was a panting moan. He turned from the window overlooking the floor of his club and peered into the darkness, but saw no one. The sound grew in rhythm and was accompanied now by a knock. Dionysus crossed the room toward a storage closet behind the bar. He pressed his ear to the door, which was soft, covered in the same black velvet that lined the walls. When he was certain the sounds came from there, he opened it. Inside were Silenus and a woman he did not recognize. The satyr leaned against one side of the closet while the woman rode him, her legs wrapped around his waist.
"Fuck!" Silenus said, and they froze. "Gods damn it, Dad!" Dionysus snapped.
Silenus laughed, breathless.
"Oh, Dionysus, it's just you."
It was not as if this was the first time he had caught Silenus engaging in sexual acts. The satyr had become part of his cult after he was cursed to wander the earth. They'd spent days at the center of orgies, giving and receiving pleasure, as was his way of worship. Still, over the years, it had become something Dionysus wished to see less and less from a man he'd come to view as his father figure. He closed the door with a sharp snap, and then plucked a bottle of wine from the selection at the bar and poured a glass. As he took his first sip, the door opened again, and the woman stumbled out. She cleared her throat and pushed her hair behind her ear.
"I am so sorry, Lord Dionysus. I did not mean..."
"Nothing to be sorry for," he said quickly, not looking at her. He took another sip of wine. "Go."
She bowed her head and stumbled away. A slice of bright light from the hallway cut through the dark as she left. Behind him, Silenus emerged.
"I was not aware you had returned," he said.
Though Dionysus was not turned toward him, he could hear the clink of his belt as he secured it.
"How long have you been in that closet?" he asked.
The satyr paused.
"I don't actually know."
Dionysus lifted a brow and glanced at his foster father.
"Then how did you know I left at all?" "I always know when you leave," Silenus said, "because I feel like I can breathe again."
"Fucking rude," Dionysus said as Silenus elbowed his way beside him at the bar. The satyr was a head shorter than him, but taller than any satyr he had ever met. It was likely because Silenus was not just a nature spirit. He was a nature god. He even looked different from others of his kind. Dionysus had seen satyrs with horse or goat feet and tails, but Silenus had the long ears of a donkey and a tail to match, though it was a form he kept hidden mostly by his glamour.
"You have never faulted me for honesty before,"
said Silenus, as he poured a glass of wine, only to down it like water. It was typical of him. He was the god of drunkenness, which was why they had paired so well for so long, their lives revolving only around revelry.
"Should I start today?"
Silenus finished the last few gulps of wine before setting the glass aside with a clank.
"Dionysus, even you know of what I speak," he said. "If you are going to spout wisdom, you need to be far more drunk." "This isn't wisdom. It is true. You have become unbearable."
"Why? Because I don't party with you anymore?"
"Well, that is a reason," the satyr said. "But it's more than that. You know it is."
Dionysus pushed back from the bar, angling toward his foster father.
"Enlighten me."
You are not having fun, Silenus said. At all. How long has it been since...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?